ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Soul Search by podcast and on ABC Radio National. It's Meredith Lake here with you. How important is music to your sense of the sacred? Maybe there's a mantra like this one that helps you centre. Or perhaps there's a piece of music that just lifts your spirits whenever you happen to hear it. Music has a long and intimate relationship with spirituality, and that's partly what I'm going to be exploring today in the company of a very special guest who's brought his guitar with him. His name is Cyprian Consilio. He's a monk and a musician. Or maybe I should have actually put that the other way around, because Cyprian was a professional musician before he embraced a vowed religious life. Hello, Cyprian.
Hello. Nice to meet you.
You too. Tell me about that. I mean, a lot of people, I think, would understand music as some kind of bridge to the sacred. But how did those things first become entangled in your own life?
Well, let's see, how do I put this? I started playing guitar when I was like 9 years old. And this was just about the time when in the Roman Catholic tradition, we were starting to sing in the vernacular.
Uh-huh.
So that's how many years ago it is, obviously. And a year after I started playing the guitar, we met this priest who was playing guitar at Mass. And I got invited to start playing guitar in church at 10 years old.
So like straight onto the roster. I love it.
Isn't that funny? So yeah. Kind of like they've been parallel tracks for me for most of my life, music and spirituality. They didn't always cross over. They didn't always go together. Sometimes they conflicted with each other.
Where did you feel the tensions?
Well, mainly I would say in my kind of wild 20s when I was much more interested in rock and roll than I was in religion, you know,
well,
and the whole lifestyle
didn't
that went with it.
God invent rock and roll, though?
It's true. And, you know, actually, one of the things I talk about, I refer to the rock and roll John the Baptist energy. The rock and roll is just this laid, you know, axe laid to the root of the tree kind of energy. Every now and then you need to wake things up, you know.
Yeah. Is that what music is about for you? A kind of awakening?
I think it goes two ways. I think I've always expressed myself the best through song, other people's song and my own songs, but also I get fed from music, and quite often music that I wouldn't necessarily sing myself, in a way that nothing else feeds me. So it really works both ways.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, what I found really interesting after I was ordained a priest and started preaching, for me, the process of writing a song and writing a sermon are almost the same process.
Really?
It's very interesting.
I've never heard songwriting described like that. You'll have to
tell
me more.
Well, because I tend to be really very almost obsessive about details. And I started out, of course, as a songwriter and a performer before I was a preacher. But if I'm writing a song, I will just scrupulously go over every word to make sure it's just the right thing and every chord change to make sure it's the right thing. You could even see in my sheet music or my lyric sheets. But I'm actually the same way with my sermons, and I will write them out and practically memorize them word for word before I offer them. So that's why those two processes go together. You know, after you've written it, like to go over it over and over again until it starts changing itself, because delivering something and writing something can be two different acts.
Yes.
And the delivering kind of changes it.
I mean, orality is its own technology in the spiritual life, really. I mean, you think about all the traditions that are centered on mantras and on the vocalizing of what's most precious and treasured. And even in the Christian tradition, the orality that still bursts through the scriptural texts themselves.
Absolutely, because I don't think people realize that the origins of chant, at least as I understand it in history, is actually just elevated speech. First, it beautifies the text, but also it's a way of proclaiming the text that can get it out over an assembly in a way that speaking won't necessarily do. And that's beautiful, this idea of a kind of a Sprechsingen. You know, when we're in choir as monks, we're singing the scriptures back and forth to each other all the time. I've sung so much a cappella music in the monastery that that's, I think, totally changed my approach to text and to music. And chant, you know, we don't want to say it's a marriage of two different things. It's just one thing. It's sung word, you know, it's word music altogether.
How has it changed your approach to the text? I'm very curious about that.
Well, first of all, there was a wonderful composer that I worked with some years ago who challenged me to not write with the guitar or the piano, to not write chord changes and put a melody on top of it, is to just approach the text and to make a strong melody. And that was like a conversion experience for me.
Wow.
And from that day on, I've been writing for, you know, all these, you know, this is going on 35, 40 years of composing. When I write singing songs, I don't use an instrument. I start out with that. And that makes me carry the text around with me and say it and walk with it until the melody reveals itself in the rhythm of the words. So that was a great entree for me to start composing plain song, even, you know, from pop music to plain song. And some of the inspiration I got to that was actually listening to some of the great jazz singers and also especially jazz saxophone players.
Really?
Like listening to John Coltrane or listening to Ornette Coleman or some folks like that, especially the introductions to sometimes to the jazz pieces where there's almost like an alap that you would have in Indian music of playing around with the melody beforehand, just, you know, find these sinuous melodies. And then I moved into listening to, you know, for example, that Hindemith solo viola concerto, which is just so wild.
Yeah.
And a lot of the solo instrument things, just to find those pure melodies. So I don't know if I've gone off topic, but that's like the first aspect of it. The second aspect of it, especially like in a church where in our monastery in California, there's this amazing acoustic. And what you do is you learn that the room itself is one of the instruments. And I perform with a marvelous percussionist. We've performed around the world together. He's really a world-class guy. We will do a sound check in a room that's almost as long as the concert, because we want to see what's in the room.
Wow.
Like, I want to know where I'm going to put the notes, what corner the notes are going to go in. And he wants to know how loud he can play the percussion, you know. So that's how this has changed my relationship to music in general.
And changed your relationship to place and to embodiment as well, right?
Yeah, and somehow it's not three different things, you know, the word, the music, and the place. They're all one. And then I want to add to that, having spent enough time in the recording studio, where there's this wonderful recording engineer who used to work with Paul Horn, the great New Age flautist. I don't know if you know that name.
Yeah, who played in the Taj Mahal.
Exactly,
that's
yeah.
That's the most amazing piece of music.
He actually was a frequent visitor at my monastery in Big Sur, and he took me to meet his recording engineer, Christopher Hedges, up in South San Francisco. And Christopher had a microphone that he made. It wasn't even one microphone. It was actually like the bust of a mannequin.
Okay.
And he had microphones all around it, so it was hearing like the human head would hear. And I mentioned something about the place, the song, and the music, and he said, have you forgotten one thing? The audience. Like the audience
community.
Who's listening is also part of that conversation too. So I just, I feel so blessed to have had all these different experiences. And this is what it actually informs my music for sure. But you see, it becomes a whole way of life.
Yes.
It becomes a spirituality.
Yeah, I was just thinking like a metaphor of like music as a bridge to the sacred clearly is not large enough to describe what you're talking about at all, Cyprian. It's much more than a bridge from one thing to another. It's a way of inhabiting something very holistic, perhaps.
Yeah, and it's also a language. It's a whole different language, isn't it? It's an intuitive language. It speaks to a different part of us. It even comes from a different part of us. So like some of these songs that I sing, for instance, I have this one piece called Compassionate and Wise, which I start out singing a Sanskrit mantra, and then I sing this piece of music that was actually an adaptation of a melody by Lorena McKennett, but a Buddhist monk put the Metta Sutta on top of it.
Uh-huh.
And in a song like that, these traditions are living together in the music. And if I teach somebody else how to sing it, interreligious dialogue is going on. It's happening, you know. It's like it's an incarnation of it right there.
Yeah, we need to talk about the role of music in interreligious dialogue. We need to talk about how you've come to all this as a Catholic in particular. But I just, well, I know you are sitting there with the guitar. Is there any chance you could just give me a taste of how that particular song sounds?
Oh, yeah, that one.
Why not?
I need to just to retune it a little bit.
Hold I'm on, putting you on the spot here.
I don't mind. It's the spot I love to be in. I just heard somebody say, guitarists spend half their life tuning. It was Paul Simon. Half their life tuning and the other half playing out of tune. Okay, this is compassionate and wise. It starts out with the Mahamrityunjaya mantra from the Indian tradition, the great mantra to overcome death. Om Trayambakam Yamjamahe Shugandim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukaliva Bandhanat Murchar Bhakshayam Amritat Om Sarvesham Svastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Santir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavantu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Sharu Niramaya Sarve Bhadrani Pushyantu Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.
Thank you.
You may have to use auto-tune on those last few notes.
I think the sound of actual life is always okay. Welcome on the radio. Thank you. Wow.
Most welcome. And, you know, I'm going to tell you about that. The monk who taught it to me actually is here in Australia on the Gold Coast. And when he told me about this, he said with kind of a twinkle in his eye, they use this as a dedication of merit, where at the end of a period of meditation, you would dedicate whatever merit you might have gained in meditation out to somebody else. Uh-huh. And he said, this is like the Buddhist version of intercessory prayer. So I've used this something like this. I have four or five different versions of this Metta Sutta from the different Buddhist schools. I use it all the time for, you know, Christian retreats or interreligious retreats. It's just a beautiful way of expressing something that we might not have expressed it, you know, in Catholicism or in Christianity. Mm. That's the universal wisdom right there. There's some words we can say in common, which are so important in this day and age, to find some words like that.
Mm. On Radio National and by podcast with the ABC Listen app, it is Meredith Lake here with you on Soul Search, and I'm in the company, the very good company of Cyprian Consiglio, a monk and a musician, as you've heard. And I know, Cyprian, that you spend a lot of time exploring what resonates, shall we say, speaking musically between different religious traditions. But at the same time, you are a Catholic priest in midlife. You were ordained into that. What drew you to vowed religious life?
Well, first I want to clarify. I'm first of all a monk, and then within the monastery, I was also ordained a priest. But my primary vocation is monk. So, you know, I'm 66 years old right now. I don't know if you figure this out. The older you get, the longer these stories become. So the short version of it. I was raised in a Catholic family. In the 60s, my parents got really involved in this kind of burgeoning new spirituality after the Second Vatican Council, social engagement and the new mass and the vernacular and home masses and things like that. And it was really fun. I was really attracted to that. And we knew several young priests who were very attractive people, you know, into social justice issues and music and things like that. So I grew up in that environment. And then I actually went to high school seminary for 3 years of my high school.
Wow.
Not so much because I had an idea that I wanted to be a priest, but I was really attracted to spirituality and to religious life. And I had a fabulous experience with that.
What was the attraction? I mean, it's the 60s. You know, a lot of young people aren't taking that path, right? This is exactly the time when there's a kind of divorce in many ways between youth culture and traditional Christian religion in the West. So what was it for you?
Yeah, well, this would be now the 70s. I think it was, these people were just very attractive. They were so on fire, you know, for life. They were creative. They were intelligent. We were having intelligent conversations. I didn't even think twice about it. It just happened so naturally. Huh. And I was attracted to the whole thing. And when I got to the seminary, there was this kind of an intellectual depth to the place that was, again, like almost a conversion experience to me, because there was art and there was language and there was theology and there was history and there was sociology, plus there was music and community. I just thought it was paradise. I didn't want to leave the high school seminary. But at the end of high school, again, I still didn't have a clear notion of wanting to be a priest, but I met these group of Franciscans who were living in the inner city of Chicago, living a contemplative life, poor with the poor, related to the Catholic worker movement. And I spent a year with them, and it was an amazing experience. Again, discovering a whole nother depth of wisdom and spirituality that you get in religious life, that, not to put secular priesthood down, diocesan priesthood down, but there's a whole nother depth you get in religious life that you don't necessarily get in diocesan priesthood. So I did that, and then I did one more year of seminary, and then I kind of had my adolescent crisis a little bit late.
In your 20s, yeah.
I left at 20, and I kind of, I did music throughout my 20s. Mm. And I had this kind of an itch again in my late 20s, as I wasn't happy with my life, to make a long story short. Tried seminary again, which really didn't work. And then I met these monks on the Big Sur coast of California. In a sense, I just fell in love. I fell in love with the life. And I say it this way, the amazing experience I had, like at 17, 18 years old, where it was nothing short of a conversion experience, it happened again when I met these monks. I said, okay, I tasted it here again. I tasted the simplicity and the depth and the directness of life. And so that I joined, that was almost 33 years ago now that I joined that monastery. It's been a bit of a twists and turns in the roads over those 30 years. I haven't been there the entire time, but that's what got me started again.
You know, I've never met someone who's walked a straight path, honest. Like, really. But when did you take the name Cyprian? And what was the significance of that name in particular?
I would say there's three reasons, and one of them is very shallow.
Shock me.
I was reading a book at the time. My name is Daniel, by Philip Daniel by birth. I always went by Daniel, and I really loved that name. Mm. I didn't really want to give it up, but somebody explained to me what it meant for him to take a new name as a monk. It was almost like to decide who you're going to be now, like to name your own identity and to really build that yourself. I was reading a book by an English monk named Cyprian Smith about Meister Eckhart, the great 13th century Dominican mystic. And I remember looking down at my desk and said, that's my name. Just that quickly. And then I thought about it. That I knew a monk, a lovely man named Cyprian Davis. He was an African-American Benedictine monk back in Indiana. And remembered that St. Cyprian is very dear to the African-American community because there's some speculation he was actually a black African himself because he was from Tunisia, that area, Carthage. And so I had a great connection with the black community when I was, again, those same years, late teenage, early 20s, singing gospel music and things like that.
Yeah.
And then secondly, there's a great monk and theologian named Cipriano Vagagini he's a Benedictine and joined our congregation late in life, who was one of the architects of the new liturgy in the church and a great theologian.
Yeah.
So all those reasons put together. But the main reason was I love the sound of it. That's the shallow reason. In Italian and in English.
Yeah.
In Italian, Cyprian Consiglio is great, but in Italian, Cipriano Consiglio, that's unbeatable. So the musician to me, that was the shallow reason.
I mean, you said taking a new name, it does mark a very fundamental shift in identity. And yet, surely it's a shift away from thinking of yourself as an individual or even in terms of personal identity, isn't it? Isn't that part of what's involved with the embrace of vowed religious life?
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to put it, actually. You know, there's kind of an old way of thinking about it and a new way of thinking about it, and maybe they go along with these framing devices I use sometimes, conforming and transforming. Like the first part of any spiritual journey, I think if we take it seriously, we all need some kind of container, some kind of framework, some kind of discipline that we conform to. And David Steindl-Rast, who's another wonderful Benedictine monk and author and teacher, he had this teaching about the ectoskeleton and the endoskeleton.
Yeah.
And the ectoskeleton holds the creature together from the outside, like a lobster.
Mm-hmm.
The endoskeleton holds you together from the inside. And so somehow that conforming to structure, putting on a structure, is supposed to somehow sink in, and then it becomes this inner structure. And that's when the transformation starts. Instead of just conforming, you're transforming from the inside out. And that's a really exciting moment in a vocation. It can also be scary.
Yeah.
As I say, my own vocation has taken twists and turns because you start becoming somebody that you didn't realize was even in the works. St. Paul says twice in his letters, when you're in Christ, there is new creation. The creation doesn't just happen once. There's this transformation, this ongoing creation, which is the evolution of our consciousness, but the evolution is of our entire being, spirit, soul, and body.
Mm.
I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what came to my mind.
I mean, the imagery of the exoskeleton and the endoskeleton.
Isn't that marvelous?
Isn't it helpful?
Really. But I think in postmodern times, we don't like the exoskeleton.
We chafe
it. We don't like the discipline. We don't like the formation. I just think it's vital. It's vital in music. It's vital in painting. It's vital in writing. It's vital in athletics. And I think it's also vital in the spiritual life. That discipline, that it holds us together. It gives us some a bit of a container for our energy. Otherwise, the energy just splashes all over the place.
Well, I guess on a bad day, my fear is that we have an exoskeleton of a cultural type that, whether we are conscious of it or not, whether we choose it or not, plays that role in our lives. And it might be our addictions to certain forms of media consumption or actual consumption or something like that. I wonder if actually we're kidding ourselves if we think we don't live with an exoskeleton of some kind.
It's true. And the same thing goes with religion.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you have a set of beliefs, in some sense, you've got religion, you've got a dogma. Mm. And we just don't realize how much we're held in a container that we may not even like if we actually recognize it. Sometimes we have to toss off those cultural containers and maybe even toss off some of the inherited religious containers. Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
On Radio National and by podcast with ABC Listen, you're listening to Soul Search. I'm Meredith Lake. I love this idea that people start out on the spiritual journey a bit like, well, Cyprian said lobsters, needing some kind of shell or container, an exoskeleton to give structure and shape to their spirituality. But then, over time, they revise and even internalise that structure, developing a spiritual endoskeleton, so to speak, perhaps becoming less like a lobster and maybe more like a fish. It's one way, at least, to imagine the spiritual journey. And that's what Soul Search is really all about, contemporary spirituality and what it looks like in people's lives. I'm talking with Cyprian Consilio. He's a musician and a monk, usually based at the New Camaldoli Hermitage in Big Sur, California. But even monks like him have to balance the external and internal aspects of religious life. So how did the interior, more contemplative aspects of spirituality really come to the fore for him?
Again, a super question. I'm going to answer it a little bit roundabout. Some people discover meditation, you know, in the more in the Asian sense, in terms of the interior journey, silent meditation, mm-hmm. as you know, a Buddhist would practice or the yoga tradition would practice, and they get rid of everything else, and that becomes their sole focus. It didn't happen that way for me, but I like to say it was like the ingredient that was missing from my diet that I didn't even realize I was missing. And it kind of glued everything together.
Yeah.
And I think that's the hunger that doesn't get satisfied quite often in Western Christianity, and why people go quite often to the Asian traditions. Mm. Is they're getting that missing ingredient that's so they find to be so vital and can't find it again when they come back to Christianity, or they haven't found it in their own churches. And from my understanding of these things, if we really take seriously the idea of the indwelling presence of the divine, God as ground of being, and the Indian tradition would also say God is ground of consciousness, which we don't have a lot of vocabulary for in Christianity, but it's there. Mm. Both God is ground of being and ground of consciousness, but certainly ground of being. You know, the great Paul Tillich in the last century spoke about this quite often. Yeah. Again, as did Meister Eckhart, the Grund. Once we discover that, if we take that, you know, at least intellectually as a fact, we want to realize that. And it's one of my favorite words. Realize, meaning, first of all, become aware of it, but realize, meaning, also make it real.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe when we become aware of it, it becomes real because it's transformative. Hmm. It's transformative. It's a deep, deep dig, but it's transformative. And once you get a taste of that transformation, there's no going. Well, there could be some going back.
Yeah.
But it ruins everything else.
Yeah, you can't go back to what was.
No, you can't. And that was kind of the story of my 20s. You know, I had this really amazing experience of the depth of spirituality, and then kind of threw myself into music and whatever I was doing in my 20s. Mm. And everything I tried, nothing ever gave me that taste again. Nothing ever satisfied me again until I joined the monastic life. And suddenly I think, oh, that was the thing. That was the thing. I tasted it again.
Hmm. This is a very personal question, perhaps, but I've spoken to a few people over the years who've had what they would call a mystical experience, and I have to say, I haven't. But I appreciate how difficult it can be to wrap up with language, too. I've met people for whom it's literally unspeakable. But can I ask you if you have, like, that spiritual experience that you referred to, was that a mystical experience as you would describe it, or I wonder if you could tell me more about it?
Yeah, we're, in my tradition, we're very hesitant to talk about those things. But I can tell you this. You know, there's this great image from the Song of Songs where the bride sees the groom, and then for the rest of the book, she's longing to see the groom again, you know, for those kisses again, which becomes a very important image for Christian mystics.
Yeah.
And I like to refer to those experiences as kisses. Mm. Kisses, and the kisses make you long for more kisses. And so I can say I've had kisses. Yeah, I've had kisses that make me long for more kisses.
And I mean, that text, the Song of Songs, is one of the gifts of the Hebrew tradition.
Yeah.
Right? That Christians have been nourished by over centuries now, as you say yourself. And I wonder if, I mean, it is about desire. We're talking about desire. How that has led you into a deep engagement with, not only with the Hebrew tradition, but with Buddhism, with the Vedic tradition that you've already referred to, Cyprian.
Yeah.
Because in the second half of the 20th century, you know, many people, as you said, you know, kind of abandoned a kind of more cerebral, perhaps institutional or brittle form of Western Christianity and found something else in an Eastern tradition. And I wonder what your experience of that has been from within the exoskeleton that you still have of your monastic life.
Yeah, I had the great grace of meeting Bede Griffiths in 1992. And the extraordinary thing about it was I was on my way into the monastery. I wasn't even officially a monk yet. And he was making his last trip to America on his way back to India. He was an English Benedictine monk who was one of three founders of a Christian ashram in South India. And I heard him speak one Saturday morning, and that 45-minute talk completely turned my life around and set me on the path that I'm on 33
another
years
conversion
later.
Experience.
It was just amazing. I mean, I'm still reaping from that one talk. And one of the things he talked about was the universal call to contemplation, not just the fact that all people are called to it, but that all traditions, this would be his point of view and the point of view of the perennial philosophy, that all religious traditions actually stem from some kind of experience of union with absolute reality or the divine or God, however you want to put it. As those traditions get expressed, you know, through their language, through their philosophy, through their iconography, through their culture, they look different from one another. One of his famous books is called Return to the Center. He says, but as we converge on that center, we find the commonality again. So he would be a big believer in what was called the perennial philosophy. And that was that famous book put out by Aldous Huxley in the mid-1940s. The idea that the great sacred traditions actually share a deposit of wisdom, that we can learn from each other and we can offer to each other. It's not that we're going to agree every step of the way.
No, it's not sameness.
No, not sameness. There's more a harmony. But there are aspects that we have in common. And it could even be that one tradition has uncovered something in a way that another tradition hasn't uncovered it yet. We all have our gifts to offer. And my favorite example, again, goes back to the meditation. I did not learn about the silence and the apophatic depth of God beyond name and form. I didn't learn about that in Catholic grade school or Catholic high school or for the first 34 years of my Catholic life. I learned about that from Buddhism, and then I learned about that from Advaita Vedanta of Hinduism, and then I found it in Christianity. But still, I would even go one step further. It's Taoism that expresses that for me in a way that I really haven't found anything in Catholic Christian literature. That's not to say Christian Catholic literature is defective, but that another tradition has expressed something that's subsistent in my own faith, that hasn't, it's been kind of inchoate in my own faith, expressed in a different way. Mm. That's been the great gift in Catholicism of the Second Vatican Council. It's actually opened ourselves up to be a world church instead of a Eurocentric church, even opening up to other forms of philosophy outside of Greek philosophy, using Asian philosophy perhaps, you know, to articulate the kerygma of Christianity.
Mm. I mean, that declaration that Vatican II made on non-Christian religions.
It's amazing.
I mean, saying that the church rejects nothing that is true and holy in other religions, and encouraging, I guess it could be interpreted as an encouragement to precisely the kind of inquiry that you're pursuing, but that Bede Griffiths before you and even Henri Lussault, also known as Swami Abhisiktananda, pursued in the 50s prior to Vatican II. But
totally encouraging it. And it it really did encourage it. And the sad thing about it is I would say 90% of Catholics don't know anything about that declaration. That know that's the official teaching of the church, is that we reject nothing of that's good and true and holy in another religion, and we're encouraged to dialogue with other traditions.
It is Meredith Lake here with you on Soul Search on ABC Radio National and by podcast with the ABC Listen app. I'm in conversation with Cyprian Consilio. He's a monk, a musician, and has a leading role now in interreligious dialogue, which it makes a lot of sense and it resonates for me, Cyprian. I'm in Alice Springs today in Central Australia on Arunda country, which the Pope visited in the 90s and made very significant statements in relation to First Nations spirituality in this country.
Wow.
And what you're talking about, in my mind at least, has huge implications for a kind of rapprochement between the old imperial Catholicism of the colonial era and a genuine conversation now about what it means to live the spiritual life in the wake of that colonialism on Arunda country or anywhere, frankly, on this continent today. The implications of this, I think, are enormous, whether you're a Catholic or not, if you're just trying to live in a place that has a history like this one. But for
That's very well put. That's very well put. Thank you for that.
I know that this inquiry has taken you again and again to India. What has that clarified for you in terms of the gifts of your own tradition in light of, I guess, the preciousness of what you found in other traditions?
Yeah. I think quite often I've met other Catholics, other Christians who get really apologetic about being Catholics and Christians, you know, when they run into other traditions.
Just and there can be reasons for that, right?
There can be reasons, but I've never been that way because I feel like Christianity in general and Catholicism in specific have something very precious to offer to the conversation. The conversation, is all the richer for us being involved in it. Specifically, I think our notion of incarnation is unparalleled. It's almost our own version of non-duality, of Advaita.
I've never thought about that before. So incarnation is a vocabulary for...
Yeah, for our version
for non-dualism.
Our version of it. I wouldn't say it's the exact same thing, but it's like our version of it. Again, I'm going to go back to Panikkar. He says, you know, the word we use for the three persons of the Trinity is perichoresis, which means like a mutual giving way to each other. And he also describes what he calls the cosmotheandric. The cosmos.
That's not a word I know.
Well, cosmo, which means the cosmos, God, and the human person. And he says the cosmos, the God, and the human person are also in a kind of a perichoresis. There's never one without the other. Mm. Isn't that beautiful?
Mm.
So he specifically is kind of, I don't want to say arm wrestling, but in dialogue a lot with the non-dual traditions. And I think he would say this is Christianity's answer to that. And the fact that we definitely say the word logos was made flesh. So many traditions fall into dualism so easy. It's so easy to think the body is bad and the soul is good, or flesh is bad and spirit is good, and we have to get rid of the matter, get rid of the body, or I like to use the Joni Mitchell line, pave paradise and put up a parking lot, because it doesn't matter what we do to earth because we're going to go to heaven. Whereas that's really not what Christianity is about.
Although there have been plenty of articulations of Christianity that have had that kind of escapist and
absolutely. No, absolutely.
dualistic
but, I mean,
approach,
it's, absolutely, but it's not Christianity. I mean, Christianity is based on the fact that the divine took flesh, that the divine became mud, the divine became blood and matter. And that's just an amazing assertion. But not only that, the whole, I'm going to use the word myth in the broadest sense possible, meaning just another way of telling the truth. The whole Christ myth also suggests that the body isn't even cast off at death. That there's a resurrection is something about, you know, the body. That empty tomb is really important in the story. And then further than that, there's the ascension where the body goes to heaven. Now, it's a glorified body according to the stories. And I always tell people not to get tripped up on the historical scientific things and don't miss the point of this great story.
Which is?
The point of the story is that the flesh shares in it somehow.
That the transformation body, you were describing, extends to our materiality.
Absolutely. But N.T. Wright is really big on this, you know, the great scripture scholar. He says Christians are so obsessed with this idea that the telos, the whole end of Christianity, is for my body to die and of soul, my soul to go to heaven. And he says that's hopelessly misleading. First of all, I like to add, because it's not all about you. You know, it's about what the whole Bible is about is heaven coming to earth. Mm. The telos of Christian life is a new heaven and a new earth. The telos of Christian life is eschatological reintegration. The whole point of Christianity is that God would be all in all, Paul says in the letter to the Corinthians. Mm. And that's just an amazing mystical vision.
Isn't it?
Amazing mystical vision. I have no idea what it means, by the way, but can't wait to find out.
Well, Cyprian, have you ever tried to get eschatological reintegration into a song lyric? That's what I want to know.
I'm going to try tonight.
Yeah. Okay. In the meantime, you did say you have your guitar with you, I know. And
I do.
And this deep engagement with the many different traditions that you've talked about, I know that that has had fruit in your own music. And I wonder if now might be the time, maybe not for a song about eschatological reintegration, but for a song that I guess...
It doesn't roll off the tongue, does it?
There's your challenge. But perhaps something else.
Yeah, I would love to share this song with you. I worked with an organization in Santa Cruz, California, called the Tent of Abraham, which was a gathering of Jews, Christians, and Muslims. We got together once a year. In some way, working with Hinduism and Buddhism and even with Taoism was not that difficult. It was just a lot of pleasure to it. But working with peace between Jews, Christians, and Muslims is a whole nother heat to it. Mm. And I spent some time in Lebanon, Syria, and in the Holy Land, and of course watching the horrors going on in that part of the world now, you know why. So this song combines the three different traditions and their relationship with the city of Jerusalem. It's called The Ground We Share, but by the ground, I mean all those things we talked about, the actual city of Jerusalem, but also the ground of our humanity itself. That's something we share. And then this ground of being in this ground of consciousness, who is the divine, that's what we share. That's the holy ground. So the first two verses are from the Psalms of Ascents of the Jewish tradition that the pilgrims would sing on their way up Mount Moriah to see the city of Jerusalem. The third verse is based on, inspired by Surah 17 of the Quran that talks about the prophets, peace be upon him, his night flight when he was taken and he had a vision. It never mentioned Jerusalem. They call it the farthest house, but it's assumed by tradition that he saw Jerusalem and was able to read the hearts of people there. And the last verse is from the book of Revelation. And this goes back to N.T. Wright's point, which apparently was the most commonly quoted piece of scripture in the patristic era, the earlier of the church. Huh. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from heaven, adorned like a bride. So I put those together with a refrain I wrote about the ground we share. And you will hear, this is kind of a lament, because we don't share the ground, but also a hope that we will learn to. The holy ground is the ground that we share, like the holy city Jerusalem, the prophet's land and my parents' land, the land of peace and the ground that we share. us go to God's house, let us hasten there. And now our feet are within your walls, in the land of peace and the ground that we share. The holy ground is the ground that we share, like the holy city Jerusalem, the prophet's land and my parents' land, the land of peace and the ground that we share. Let my tongue be mute, let my hands fall off, if I place you not over every other care. And God forbid I remember not the land of peace and the ground that we ground that we share, like the holy city Jerusalem, the prophet's land and my parents' land, the land of peace and the ground that we share. God's servant was carried by the Holy One to the farthest house late at night through the air. He saw the good and the evil done in the land of peace on the ground that we share. The holy ground is the ground that we share, like the holy city Jerusalem, the prophet's land and my parents' land, the land of peace on the ground that we share. Saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from heaven like a bride prepared. God will dwell in the midst of us, in the land of peace, in the ground that we share. The holy ground is the ground that we share, like the holy city Jerusalem, the prophet's land and my parents' land, the land of peace and the ground that we share. The land of peace and the ground that we share. The land of peace and the ground that we share.
Cyprian Consiglio, The Ground That We Share, a song of lament and hope, performed live here on Soul Search. I've been thinking about Salem, peace as a place, salam in Arabic, shalom in Hebrew, and just I think many, many people are just so grieved and so distressed by the absence of salam.
And that's why this work is so important. It may not be big and flashy. It may not be the imposition of a new order, but it's kind of like yeast in the dough, getting people to talk to each other, getting people to learn about each other's traditions, building bonds of friendship between people. That's, you know, some of those great images of the reign of God that Jesus uses. It works from the inside out. And yeah, that's why I feel like this work is really, really important in this day and age. Very important.
And yet you're obviously optimistic of the meaning and the significance and the worthwhileness of that. But I guess, again, on a bad day, I mean, I'm being perfectly honest here, Cyprian, I wonder how to hold to anything like a universal call to be responsive to the ground of our being or the ground of our consciousness, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I'm not going to correct you on that, but I want to offer you a different vision of it. This is Cornel West, this beautiful articulation of this I've used so often. He says optimism is a secular construct. it's a kind of a calculation that things are working out all right. But he says, "I'm a blues man." He says, "I'm a prisoner. I'm a prisoner of hope." Hope is a whole different thing. It's a theological thing. It's a surety. Mm-hmm. Optimism is a calculation. Hope is something deeper. It's really belief that God would be all in all. It's a real belief that the arc of history is long and that it leans towards justice,
as
towards
Martin
God
Luther
saving
King
justice.
Said.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. That's so. I can't say I'm optimistic. You know, especially after the political season we went through in the United States. Mm. But I'm a like Cornel West and like the prophets. I'm a prisoner of hope. I'm a prisoner of hope. Yeah. Mm.
And so finally, maybe that's the exoskeleton for our time. But how do you read the beyond your immediate community as someone who does, you know, travel so widely and observe the world so closely and interact with so many different people? How do you read, I guess, that yearning for a hope and that hunger for an interiority? How are they alive in the world now beyond the traditional containers for those as you see it?
My first thought about that is I'm just startled and amazed every day at the beauty of human beings and the resilience of the human person, the human spirit, and the spark you see in people's eyes and the smile you see on people's faces, and the fact that people are just up and doing it in spite of the hardships there are. So that gets me up in the morning. I don't know that people even know that they're hungry for interiority, but I feel like that's part of the work that we do, is to try to encourage, not always trying to find the answers outside of us, but to have a whole new understanding of who you are as a human being and to help you realize, again, become aware of and make real the fact that the divine is the ground of your being. And to have an experience of that is a transformative experience. There's a part of you that is and always has been in direct contact with the divine. Mm. And to have an experience of that just changes everything. It almost kind of turns the whole world inside out.
And gives doesn't us the different world need kind that?
Of a strength. Oh, yeah. And gives us a strength and a whole different kind of strength and a hope. Maybe it's a quieter one.
Hmm. Cyprian, thank you so much for this conversation. I have enjoyed this immensely.
Oh, I have too. Thank you. I love talking about this stuff, as you can see.
Yeah, well, me too. I really, really appreciate you making time for this conversation, for sharing so generously of what you've learned and practiced and had insight into. It's been a huge privilege. So thank you so much.
Thank you. God bless you.
Cyprian Consiglio, with a quiet word of hope and some music for you on Soul Search. Cyprian's a monk with the Monastery of New Camaldoli in Big Sur, California. He's also a musician, a writer, and the General Secretary for Monastic Interreligious Dialogue. Cyprian visited Australia back in late 2024. That's when I caught up with him and recorded this conversation. I hope you've enjoyed listening back to it on ABC Radio National. Next time on Soul Search, we're taking a trip to remote Central Australia. In Ginger Porter community, nearly everyone describes themselves as Aboriginal and Catholic. But what shape might that take across different generations? Hear about it on Soul Search next time, conversations that made a big impact on me. To hear them, follow Soul Search as a podcast with ABC Listen. For now, thanks to producers Alice Walker and Rowan Salmond. I'm Meredith Lake, and I hope you'll join me again by podcast on Radio Australia and ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.